she said, dismissing his unspoken request. We'll have to think of something else. They fell silent. Two key components of the magic weapon had been wrenched from their grasp.
I knew we'd never make it,
whined Goimgar, unable to hide his glee.
A fat lot of use you are,
Boindil growled.
I say we throw him back down again. We've lost half the ingots, so we may as well get rid of the pesky artisan as well.
So what if we've lost a few ingots? Said Tungdil, determined to raise their spirits. We're on our way to a dwarven kingdom, remember? We're bound to find enough gold and tionium to make a solitary axe. Problem solved. Andokai nodded, giving her leather armor a final tug. Excellent. If we've all recovered sufficiently, we may as well get going. Divide yourselves up between the wagons, ordered Tungdil, who was beginning to warm to being in command. We'll take turns pushing until we reach a downward pitch. Don't worry about that, said the Maegar. She motioned to Jerun. Leave it to him. Beroine's folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle. This time, Nodon's army attacked from the sides. Dwarven missiles sped toward the approaching siege engines, passing through the moist cladding of human skin, punching holes in the timber and shattering the joists. The sheer scale of the invasion ensured that some of the engines approached unscathed. At length, three wooden towers drew alongside the parapets. As the ramps clapped down, hordes of screeching orcs spewed forth, but the ferocious dwarves stood firm. Belendilin proved himself an able commander, defending the stronghold so successfully that not a single assailant made it through the dwarven lines.
Pour oil on the wood!
He shouted as soon as the first wave of invaders had been repelled. Already the next wave of beasts was streaming into the towers. The plan worked. In no time, the siege engines disappeared in a blaze of yellow flames. The wood burned like cinder, the flammable sap fueled the fire, the ropes ignited, and the towers collapsed, raining debris to the ground. The enemy retreated, yelping with fear. Victory came at a price. 14 dwarves were slain by an elf, who concealed himself on the ramp of the third tower and bombarded them with arrows, showing no regard for the hungry flames. At last his cloak caught alight, but the onslaught continued, ending only when his bowstring was consumed in the blaze. In spite of the casualties, the mood was upbeat. There was no reason to believe that Ogre's death would fall.
You fought bravely and well, Belendilin praised his troops. Our fallen brothers will live on in our memories, and their names shall be etched in gold in the kingdom's great hall.
His eyes roamed over the rows of defenders. Their bearded faces gazed back at him, sweaty but smiling. There was plenty of fight in them yet.
Vrakas gave us...
Orcs!
The shout came from a sentry who had turned his back to the gates and was listening to the king.
They've got into the stronghold!
There were hundreds of them. The snarling, roiling brutes were demolishing anything and anyone in their path. In no time, they had seized the inner rampart. They held up their swords, axes, lances and shields triumphantly, taunting the assembled dwarven army.
The tunnels! They must have come up through the tunnels! The high pass must not be breached! Children of the smith, I call on you to destroy the invaders!
Cried Belendilin, rousing his soldiers from their shock.
Every beast must die!
The dwarves jolted into action, storming up the mountainside to fight their ancient foe. Among them was their one-armed king, whose courage and tenacity were an inspiration to them all. At that moment, an ogre emerged from the underground hall, lips pressed to an enormous bugle. His piercing call drew cheers and roars from the troops outside the stronghold. The second assault on the ramparts began. Chapter 5. Beroine's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle.
They shouldn't have got this far. Why weren't they stopped by the guards?
Belendilin had no time to consider what had happened to the warriors who were guarding the entrance to the tunnels. He and his army were battling a seemingly endless onslaught of ogres, orcs, and Bognilim. For every beast he felled, two more appeared before him, and he could always be sure of hewing flesh. At last, Belendolin's guards managed to turn the tide of the surprise attack and drive the invaders back to the tunnels. The battle was bloody and cost many dwarven lives, but the king's troops finally reached the threshold of the hall, where the underground network began. They could advance no farther.
How many more?
Belendolin's heart sank as he surveyed the waiting beasts. They were trapped in the hall, but by no means defeated, and their numbers were swelling as the tunnels disgorged more orcs. A messenger pushed his way through the dwarven ranks, bringing more bad tidings for Belendolin.
The beasts have outmaneuvered us, he gasped. They've attacked from the rear. The gates of Ogre's Death are open, and the first two ramparts have been taken.
By now, Belendolin was beginning to suspect that the dwarves had been betrayed.
Flood the ramparts with boiling oil, he ordered. That will... We can't! They've destroyed the vats!
Destroyed?
A moment ago, he had been confident that the enemy would be defeated. Now his faith seemed misplaced.
To destroy the vats, they'd have to know where to find them. In which case...
Give the order to retreat! We'll defend the stronghold from within! Close the gates and abandon the ramparts!
He clapped him on the shoulder.
Hurry!
The messenger nodded and sped away. Belendolin was certain that the secondling's predicament had nothing to do with bad luck. Not only had they been attacked through the tunnels, whose existence had been secret for hundreds of cycles, but their defenses had been sabotaged by enemies who seemed to know the stronghold inside out, and now they were in danger of being outmaneuvered. Someone with intimate knowledge of Ogre's Death had helped them to plan the invasion.
What kind of dwarf would do such a thing?
Belendolin could think of no one who would stoop so low as to ally themselves with orcs.
Nadon must have used his sorcery to draw out our secrets.
There was no time to hesitate. He had to act fast.
I need 200 warriors. The rest of you stay here and hold back the orcs, he commanded, turning and marching away.
He was on course for the high pass, where he intended to destroy the bridge before the orcs got hold of it and allowed fresh hordes to flood into the stronghold from the outer lands. His fury and hatred of Nadon grew stronger with every step. Underground Network, Kingdom of Weyoun, Gerdlegard, Winter, 6,234th Solar Cycle.
Surely he must be tired by now, said Rodario, puzzled. I'd be exhausted if I had to push both wagons.
Unlike some people, Jeroen is no stranger to hard work, the Magus said sternly. The impresario gave her an injured look and stuck out his chin.
Perhaps the estimable Magus could tell me what I've done to be treated with such contempt.
She turned her back on him. Climb in, Jeroen. There's another downward pitch. The armored giant squeezed into the rear wagon, trying to make himself as small as possible so as not to injure the others or crack his head on any low archways.
Very well, said Rodario, refusing to give in. You can ignore me if you like, but prepare for the consequences. I happen to be writing a drama in which you play a leading role. You'll have only yourself to blame if you make a bad impression.
The Magus' eyes bored into his. Perhaps Jeroen should attend the first performance. You'll know from his reaction whether I like your play. If he raises his axe, you should run. The impresario held her gaze, but she refused to back down.
It isn't because of anything you've done, Rodario. Quite frankly, I don't like your manner. It's foppish.
Rodario frowned, his mood completely spoiled.
Why don't you come straight out and tell me that I'm not a real man? In your opinion, a man must have muscles, know-how to wield a sword and command the mystic arts.
You understand me better than I thought, she said scathingly. Since you fail on all three counts, you should stop your tiresome flirting. It's getting on everyone's nerves.
The Magus' put-down was delivered in her usual strident voice. Rodario went a deep shade of red and was about to retaliate when the wagon plunged and picked up speed. Ink spilled out of the open bottle, washing over the parchment and onto his clothes. He fell into a wounded silence. With one hand resting on the brake, Tungdil peered ahead, hoping to spot any potential obstacles before it was too late. Of course, if the rail was broken, nothing would save them. Bewindle was sitting beside him, eyes straining into the darkness too. There was a generous gap between the two wagons, and soon they were travelling at top speed. Suddenly, the temperature seemed to rise, and the warm wind buffeting their faces acquired the sulphurous odour of rotten eggs.
"There's light ahead!" shouted Boindil. "It looks orange!"
Shooting out of the tunnel, they raced toward another bridge, whose basalt pillars spanned a vast lake, the surface of which was incandescent with light. Lava twisted and snaked its way along the bottom, causing the crystal-clear water to bubble and boil. The rising vapors warmed the air and made the atmosphere so humid that sweat started streaming from their pores. Breathing was difficult, not least because of the stench. The molten lava lit up the cavern, a vast, irregular hollow of 2 or more miles across, with a ceiling some 500 paces above the water. Their wagons trundled over the long bridge. Tungdil glanced over the side.
"A spectacular place, but I'll be glad to get out of here."
At that moment, they heard hammering again. It began with a single rap, a piercing tone that rose above the gentle bubbling of the water. Gawimgar's head whipped back and forth as he strove to locate its source.
"It's the ghosts of our forefathers," he whispered. "My great-grandmother told me stories about bad dwarves who trespassed against the laws of Rakkas. They were barred from the Eternal Smithy and condemned to roam the underground passageways. They avenge themselves on any mortal who crosses their path."
"I suppose you believe the stories about man-eating orcs as well," said Bavrigor with a scornful laugh. "Oh, those stories are true," Boindil growled from the front. "I can vouch for that. His great-grandmother was probably right."
Gawimgar shrank down farther into the wagon, until only his eyes were visible over the side.
"That's enough, Boindil," Tungdil said sharply.
Even as he spoke, a second rap echoed through the grotto, reverberating against the glowing stone walls. This time, it didn't stop. The raps grew louder, and the intervals briefer, until the hammering swelled to a deafening staccato that shook the rock, dislodging loose stones from the ceiling. Small fragments rained down on them, missing the bridge by a matter of paces and splashing into the bubbling lake.
"Look!"
shrieked Gawimgar, beside himself with fear.
"Rakkas, have mercy on us! The spirits are coming to drag us to our deaths!"
They looked up to where he was pointing. Figures detached themselves from the rock and stared down at them. Tungdil counted at least 300 before he gave up. Still, they kept coming. There was no denying that they looked like dwarves. Some were wearing armor, some dressed in normal garb, others clad in little more than a leather apron. Male, female, warriors, smiths and masons, their pale faces stared accusingly at them, and the hammering increased. Suddenly their arms flew up in unison and pointed in the direction the travelers had come.
"They want us to leave," whispered Gawimgar. "Turn back, I beg you, let's walk across Girdlegard. I'll fight the orcs, I promise."
Spirits.
Tungdil's blood ran cold at the sight of their empty stares. The molten lava stained their ashen faces with its blood-red glow. He had read about ghosts in Lotionen's books, and now he'd seen the living proof.
"I'm not going to let you ruin our mission."
They swept into the next tunnel, away from the cavern, the lake, and the spirits. After a while, the hammering faded too. Beroen's folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle. It was just as Belendalin had feared. On reaching the high pass, he and his warriors found dead dwarves strewn across the ramparts, blood trickling across the stone. They hadn't had time to draw their weapons and defend themselves, which seemed to suggest that the murderer had been a friend.
"A friend bewitched by Nadon and turned traitor. Confound the wizard and his magic."
The air was foul with the stench of orc, and they could hear the rattle of cogs and the clatter of stone as the bridge unfolded slab by slab. The traitor had beaten them to it.
"Run!"
shouted Belendalin. There was no need to say more. Everyone knew what had to be done if disaster was to be averted. Tearing up the steps, they made for the chamber that housed the mechanism operating the bridge. On the other side of the chasm, the beasts were braying and cheering in excitement as the gangway unfurled. The dwarves tried not to listen to their shouts. Suddenly, they found themselves confronted by a guard of 100 orcs, tall, powerful specimens, bristling with weaponry. Belendilin and his warriors would have to fight tooth and nail to get through. Both sides threw themselves into the battle with ferocity, each more determined than ever to wipe their enemies from the face of the earth. Green blood mingled with red, limbs were severed, teeth sent flying, and the blood-curdling noise of the fighting competed with shouts and jeers from the hordes across the chasm whose rapacious hunger could barely be contained. Belendilin's arm grew heavier with every blow. His muscles were tiring from the strain of wielding his axe, but stubbornness kept him from flagging.
"Show no mercy!" he cried. "The bridge must be destroyed before it's too late!"
"It's too late already, Belendilin," said Bislapur.
The words echoed through the stone stairway, but of the speaker there was no sign. He didn't sound particularly troubled by the secondling's plight.
"The dwarves of Beruin and Goimdil will meet their doom together. It was easy enough to arrange, once the orcs were acquainted with the tunnels."
"You told them?"
The king's axe slashed the vile visage of an orc. There was a sound of shattering bone, and the beast toppled over, his skull a bloodied wreck. The path was clear, and the dwarves surged into the chamber to attack the last dozen foes who were prepared to die rather than lose control of the bridge. Gasping for breath, Belendilin stopped for a moment.
"Why?"
"This isn't what I wanted, but you thwarted my plans with your ridiculous challenge to the succession. Thanks to you and the High King, I had to improvise a little, but I'm not one to mourn what might have been. I wanted a war against the elves, but orcs will do the job just as well, if not better."
Belendilin tried to see where the voice was coming from, but the echo was deceptive.
"I'll kill you for your treachery,"
he vowed, full of loathing. His words were met with mocking laughter.
"Others have threatened the same, but they've never made good on their promise. You won't either, King Belendilin, not now that I've deprived you of your subjects and your stronghold."
Belendilin lingered no longer, rushing instead to join the surviving warriors in the battle for the chamber. At last, he risked a glance through an embrasure. 2/3 of the bridge had been lowered already, and a few of the beasts, unable to restrain themselves, were jumping the gap. Some fell to their deaths. Others caught hold of the edge and dangled for a moment before plummeting into the chasm below.
"We have to stop them!"
Belendilin let out a ferocious battle cry and threw himself against the last remaining orc, driving his axe with all his might into the creature's side. The blade ate its way through the grease-smeared armor, releasing a jet of dark green blood. He pulled out his weapon, parried his antagonist's sword, and struck where he had hit before. After a third blow, the beast staggered and died. It was only then that Belendilin caught sight of the twisted levers and broken handles that served to operate the bridge.
"The bridge is down,"
one of his soldiers reported.
"The beasts are storming the kingdom, Your Majesty!"
Frozen in horror, Belendilin stared at the mangled machinery. He grabbed the lever on which the future of his kinsfolk, the future of all Gerdlegard, depended, but it was jammed.
"Don't forsake your children, Vrakas!"
he cried in desperation, leaning against it with all his force. Changing his tactics, he tore out the lever, rammed his blade into the slot, and pulled down on the shaft. He looked out. It was working. The columns retracted, and the walkway dropped a few paces, sagging dangerously in the middle. Belendilin heard the vast stone slabs snapping and cracking, then the noise was drowned out by screams of terror as the invading beasts realized that nothing could stop them from plunging to their deaths. At that moment, the bridge gave way, pulling the creatures with it. The assembled hordes on the far side of the chasm howled in disappointment.
"Your Majesty, you're wounded,"
said one of his warriors in concern. Belendilin looked down to see blood seeping from the left side of his torso. There was a huge slit in his chainmail where an orcish sword had struck.
"It's nothing,"
he mumbled, wrenching his axe from the slot.
"We'll finish off the creatures who made it over the bridge, then go back to help the others. We'll deal with the traitor later."
As they battled their way back to the tunnels, it became apparent that the Blue Range was riddled with enemy troops. Every corridor, every passageway, Every chamber brought forth more orcs and Bognilim patrolling the territory in small groups or big gangs.
How much longer will we be able to hold them back?
Belendalin prayed to Vrakas for help. On approaching the entrance to the tunnels, they heard the bestial cries of dying orcs. From the sound of it, the enemy troops were being massacred.
I gave the warriors strict instructions not to attack. A pitched battle would be fatal. We'll be outnumbered.
The king and his company hurried to the aid of their comrades, but were greeted by an entirely unexpected and inexplicable sight. Advancing in the opposite direction was a battalion of dwarves who had popped up behind the orcs and taken them by surprise. While the battalion cut its way through the beasts from the rear, Belendalin's own troops had seized the initiative and launched an offensive, thereby squeezing the enemy between two fronts. Belendalin ordered his company to attack, and they joined the fray. At length, the two dwarven armies met in the middle, their gleaming axes making quick work of the last orcish troopers.
I don't like to be late for a battle, declared a warrior in beautifully fashioned mail.
The voice was a little high-pitched, the beard on the thin side, and the armor revealed two large bulges that seemed distinctly unmanly. The dwarf was clutching a golden mace, now stained with orcish blood.
I'm Xamptis II, of the clan of the Stubborn Streaks, queen of Borengar's folk, and commander of the Firstlings.
She turned one of the corpses over with her foot.
I came here for a meeting of the assembly, and what do I find? Orcs. I suppose it's one way of letting off steam between debates.
Belendalin quickly recovered from the surprise.
Queen Xamptis, you are most welcome here. Thank you for coming to the aid of your cousins in their hour of need. My name is Belendalin One-Arm, of the clan of the Firmfingers, king of the Secondlings. Was it Tungdil or Gandagar who asked you to come?
He prayed silently that it was Tungdil.
It was Tungdil. He convinced me to put an end to the cycles of silence.
She held out her hand, and he shook it.
What's going on here?
He described in as few words as possible the fate that had befallen Ogre's death, and the betrayal of the dwarves by their own. He was interrupted by a messenger bearing news that the main gates were about to fall to the besiegers.
Leave the range, Xamptis advised him. If you've been betrayed, they'll know every passageway and every cavern.
She placed a hand on his shoulder.
Come to my kingdom and shelter with the Firstlings until Nodon has been defeated and the beasts thrown out of your lands. I can't, he said quickly. King Belendalin, this is no time for stubbornness, she said gently. You and your folk will be overwhelmed by the enemy. And for what gain? My warriors will have their work cut out saving Girdlegard without you. I propose that we take the tunnel back to my kingdom and send messages to Tungdil and Gandagar to inform them of the change of plan.
She studied Belendalin's face and saw with relief that he knew she was right.
Get the womenfolk and children out of here, he instructed his guards. Squeeze as many of them as possible into the wagons. Anyone left behind will have to wait for our return. Lone dwarves will have no trouble concealing themselves in the mines and quarries. Destroy the key bridges. The orcs will be hard-pressed to track them down.
Withdrawing the troops and abandoning the kingdom amounted to a defeat, but Belendalin had no choice if his folk were to survive.
We wouldn't be in this position if it weren't for Bisnapur, he thought bitterly.
He put his mind to organizing the retreat and dispatched volunteers to convey the news to the far reaches of the kingdom and warn the clans that the army had withdrawn.
Tell them it won't be for long, he commanded. I give my word that I'll be back in a few weeks to kill the orcs.
He hurried away to the great hall, anxious to save the ceremonial hammer from desecration by the beasts. There was no need to worry about the Secondling's hoard. The treasures were protected by a runic password known only to the king. Belendalin picked up the hammer from its place beside the abandoned throne and listened to the battering rams thudding against the main gates. The pounding noise went straight through him, heralding the doom of Ogre's death as clearly as if Tion himself were thumping on the door. He took a last melancholy look at the throne. The stone pews, the tablets inscribed with Vrakas's laws, the lofty columns and the beautifully sculpted bas-reliefs. Golden sunshine sloped through the chinks in the ceiling, bathing the hall in warm light.
How much of this will be left when I return?
Surely the king isn't abandoning his realm.
Bisnapur!
Belendalin whipped round toward the marble tablets. The traitor stepped out from behind one of them, the stone trinkets in his beard tinkling softly as he walked.
I was hoping to meet you alone, without any of your slavish attendants. It was tiresome of you to destroy the bridge. I was sorry to see it go.
He raised his axe and drove it into one of the sacred tablets, cracking the stone and breaking it apart.
But patience is a virtue. The orcs will destroy your kingdom, just as I will put pay to your laws.
The king descended from the dais.
You can shatter the tablets, but the words will be carved again. You shan't destroy us, Bislapur. The children of the smith stand united. Haven't you heard? The firstlings have come to our aid, and many of your allies have been slain by their axes.
They're not allies. They work on my behalf. The orcs are only instruments of my revenge,
Bislapur said calmly. He demolished the remains of the tablet.
Enjoy your little victory while you can. You'll never defeat Nodon. He's dangerous in his insanity, and he's far too powerful for you.
The second tablet shattered, splinters of polished stone striking the flagstones and scattering across the floor.
Enough!
Belendolin was at the foot of the dais and nearly upon the traitor. Without stopping, he dropped the hammer and drew his axe from his belt. The fourthling was stronger, he knew, but his lameness made him slow and clumsy.
Tell me why!
A fine duel this will be, laughed Bislapur. Two cripples locked in combat.
This isn't a battle of words, the king said grimly.
Bislapur smiled.
I guess the dwarves of Berwyn will have to find a new leader.
His axe hurtled out of nowhere, but Belendolin ducked, flinging out his arm and using his momentum to strike. Cursing, Bislapur leapt back, but the metal spike on Belendolin's axe head caught his unarmored calf, ripping through leather and fabric. Blood oozed from the wound.
Why are you doing this?
Belendolin demanded.
Is it because your favorite wasn't elected High King? Are you so obsessed with waging war on the elves that you betrayed your own kin? Is that it?
Bislapur rushed forward and launched a series of feint attacks. But Belendolin saw through them and drew back, steeling himself for the real assault. They had crossed the breadth of the vast hall and were battling along a passageway that led to a bridge. The ground was 20 or more paces beneath them.
The succession never interested me, spat Bislapur. My only desire was for war. The elves would have destroyed you.
He dealt the blow so forcefully that it was impossible to parry. At the last moment, Belendolin managed to deflect it, but he almost lost his axe.
It makes no sense, Bislapur. Has Nodon bewitched you? Why would you betray your folk?
My folk? The Fourthlings aren't my folk. You were closer to the truth than you realized.
His axe whistled through the air. Belendolin blocked it, but the force of the blow numbed his hand.
I'm too strong, too warlike to be a puny son of Goindil. Remember, you said so yourself.
He struck again, and this time the axe flew out of Belendolin's fingers and clattered to the bridge.
I'm a child of Lorimbor, and I will go down in history as the thirdling who brought misery on the other dwarven folks, he said darkly. I have succeeded where all others failed.
Belendolin grabbed his arm and stopped the next blow, but the traitor headbutted him with his helmet. The king staggered backward, his vision starry and bloodied. Bislapur's cocky laughter rang in his ears.
What a blow to you that Tungdil is a thirdling, or he could have succeeded you on the throne. Oh, he'll weep when he sees the ruins of Ogre's death. I've a good mind to stick around and ambush him. Killing him and his miserable company would give me pleasure.
A thirdling? Never!
It was all Belendolin could do not to fall from the bridge.
I know my kind when I see them. It's an instinct we've got. Trust me. Your protégé is a thirdling, a dwarf killer. You may as well get used to the idea, before I kill you and feed your entrails to the orcs.
You lie!
The king leaned back against the parapet, his legs giving way. Smiling malevolently, Bislapur raised his axe.
What if I do? You're going to die anyway.
The blade swooped down, but Belendolin saw only a fleeting shadow. Underground Network, Kingdom of Tabayin, Girdlegard, Winter, 6,234th solar cycle. The sound of falling rock gave Tungdil just enough warning to pull on the brake. Even so, the force of the collision sufficed to throw the wagon from the rail and give its passengers a thorough shaking.
"The spirits need to work on their timing," said Bavrogor, wiping the dust from his brow.
He turned to Belindis, who let him wipe her face.
"I bet the ceiling was meant to collapse on us."
He reached for his drinking pouch and took a sip of brandy.
"It's nothing to worry about," Rodario scowled, springing from the wagon. "Our industrious giant will clear away the debris, and we'll soon be on our way."
He glanced at Andrikai.
"Unless, of course, the estimable Mega would prefer to blast through the tunnel with one of her gusts."
His tone was deliberately sniffy. He was still cross with the Mega for spurning his advances in front of the group. Goimgar, pale with fear, kept his eyes suspiciously on the ceiling, and refused to leave the safety of his seat. Meanwhile, Andrikai was already inspecting the blocked tunnel and giving instructions for the rubble to be cleared. It soon became apparent that the task was too much, even for Jerun.
"By the look of things, the ceiling has gone entirely," said Bavrogor,
who was clambering over the fallen rock and studying the walls.
"I'd say someone went to a lot of trouble to organize this."
Fergus hurried to take a closer look. He ran his hands over the rock, then nodded.
"You're right. The roof of the tunnel is riddled with holes. Whoever it was wanted to make certain that the ceiling would collapse once the struts were knocked away."
"Ghosts," whispered Goimgar tremulously. "We should have listened to their warning. They're trying to get us killed."
Boindel turned on him fiercely.
"I never thought I'd say this, but Hammerfist's drunken singing is 1,000 times more bearable than your complaining."
His inner furnace had been burning high for some time, and he needed to let off steam.
"Keep a check on yourself, Boindel," Tungdil pleaded. "I know it's hard and it's been a long while, but you mustn't let your temper get the better of you."
He rummaged through his knapsack and brought out Xamtis's map.
"We have to turn back. There's an exit about a mile from here."
He turned to Goimgar.
"The spirits have answered your prayers. We're going back to the surface."
"Whereabouts are we?" asked Andrikai.
"According to my calculations, we're in the southeastern corner of the Kingdom of Tabayin. It shouldn't be too much of a problem to find the next entrance. Tabayin is dead flat. It's just one vast plain."
"It's not fair," Bavrogor grumbled moodily. "Why should cowardly little Shimmerbeard get his way? All that blasted riding was bad enough. I'm not built for traipsing around overland, and I can't say I'm fond of the sun." "You'll get used to it soon enough," snapped Boindel. "If you'd taken your turn at the high pass with the rest of us, you'd know that sunshine can be pleasantly warming." "It wasn't worth the risk," Bavrogor snapped back. "I didn't want to end up like my sister."
Belindis stiffened. Sensing the sudden tension, she stepped in front of Bavrogor to stop things from getting out of hand. He grabbed her arm and pushed her away.
"Be careful," he warned her. "Don't turn your back on him when he's angry. His axe moves faster than his mind."
The warrior's muscles tensed, his hands gripping the hafts of his axes.
"Is that right?"
he growled, lowering his head belligerently.
"Stop it, both of you,"
commanded Tungdil.
"The two of you can carry the ingots until you've used up your excess energy. Jerun will take over when you're tired."
They reluctantly obeyed. Tungdil fell into step with Belindis and briefly recounted the history of the feud.
"Neither will give an inch. One of them is overburdened by grief, the other by anger."
"It's sad," she said, her plump face full of compassion. "Sad for both of them."
He dropped his voice, stopped walking, and leaned toward her.
"Maybe we'll run into a pack of orcs so Boindel can work off his anger. I'd rather we didn't have to, but it might be for the best."
Her scent filled his nostrils. She smelled as delectable as fresh oil or polished steel.
"What are you waiting for, Tungdil?"
shouted Goimgar, who had finally left the wagon and was hurrying after the others.
"Maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought leaders were supposed to lead."
"You're absolutely right."
He hurried past him and joined Boindel and Bavrogor, who were carrying their burdens in silence. Neither wanted to appear weaker than the other by handing their ingots to Jerun and admitting defeat. Suddenly they heard a loud rattling ahead. The next instant, A wagon sped down the rail toward them. In the nick of time, they leapt aside. Jeroen whipped out his axe and brought it down in one fluid movement. The wagon flipped off the rail and flew into the wall. At once the giant was beside it. He turned it upside down to check for passengers. There were none.
That's funny. I suppose someone must have left it in a side passage, and now it's worked its way free, said Rodario. Luckily, I've got the reflexes of a panther. Otherwise, I'd be dead.
Fergus responded with an incredulous look.
The ghosts, whimpered Goimgar. They're trying to kill us.
Don't be ridiculous,
Boindel said witheringly. He set down the ingots, went up to the wagon, and sniffed at it.
Well, it certainly hasn't been near any orcs. I'd be able to smell the fat on their armor.
He crawled into the wagon and emerged only when he had something to show for his efforts.
A shoe buckle,
he announced, lifting it up for the others to see.
Silver alloy. It's not especially old, but it looks quite worn, judging by the dirt and scratches.
He pocketed it.
I've seen that buckle somewhere before, thought Tungdil to himself.
We can't do anything about it now, he told the others. Let's carry on. Boindel scooped up his ingots, and the company marched off. Beroine's folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle. Belindelin flung himself to the ground. The blade whistled over his head and crashed into the side of the bridge. He kicked up at Bislapur, driving his foot into his groin, then drew his dagger and rammed it into his boot. In an instant, the traitor's groan became a bellow. At last, Belendalin's vision cleared, and he could see his antagonist above him, just in time to avoid the furious blow rushing his way. He rolled to the side, and the axe hit the bridge. This time, Bislapur was prepared, and the weapon rose again, swinging up toward Belendalin. The blade sliced through his chainmail, penetrating his wounded chest. The spike on top of the axe head embedded itself in the metal rings.
Fly away, you one-armed cripple, laughed Bislapur.
He gripped the axe with both hands and pulled his enemy toward him, only to hurl him against the balustrade. Belendalin slid to the edge of the bridge and saw the chasm beneath him.
That's if you can fly with one hand.
Let's see if you do any better, cried the king,
reaching out to stab him with his dagger. The blade entered the traitor's forearm just as Belendalin rolled over the side. Hanging on to the dagger with all his might, he pulled the screaming Bislapur with him.
I'm taking the traitor with me, he vowed.
To his great surprise, his flight ended after only 2 paces as he slammed onto a ledge that was all that remained of an ancient archway erected beneath the bridge. The dagger tore through his enemy's arm. Bislapur shot past him, letting go of the axe to make a grab for the protruding stone. He succeeded in stopping his fall, but dangled by one hand. The dagger had slit his other arm from the wrist to the elbow.
It isn't over yet,
he gasped, choking with pain and exertion as he dragged himself onto the ledge. His eyes blazed with hatred.
I only need one hand to strangle you, Belendalin.
He crawled across the stone toward him. With a terrible shriek, the king seized the axe embedded in his chainmail and tore it out of his chest.
Oh, it's over all right,
he shouted, smashing the blade against the traitor's helmet. There was a cracking and splintering noise as the metal crashed into his skull. Blood streamed down Bislapur's face.
I promised to kill you, and I've kept my word.
He let go of the haft, thrust his foot into the traitor's face, and pushed him over the edge. The bleeding body plunged down, hitting the ground 20 paces below with a muffled thud and splattering over the stone.
May your soul smolder forever in Vrakas's flames.
Belendalin closed his eyes and lay down on the ledge. The next moment, he blacked out with pain. They found him, barely conscious and dangerously close to falling from the narrow shelf. He was carried to the tunnels, where his wagon was the last to leave. Kingdom of Tabayin, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle. The snow sparkled for the last time that afternoon, as the sun dropped below the flat horizon. Thousands of glittering diamonds studded the immense white plain as daylight faded to dusk. Suddenly, in the middle of the untouched snow, A boulder began to stir. Cracks opened in its white cladding, then it rolled to one side, and a woman struggled out of the ground beneath it. She stood up and took a few paces, cutting a channel through the immaculate blanket of flakes.
"Samusin, protect us!"
gasped Andokai as she surveyed the perfectly flat land. In the far distance, dark splodges marked the site of settlements, and each was topped with a column of smoke. She knelt down to make herself less visible and pulled her cloak tighter to keep out the biting cold.
"The orcs are here already. They must have invaded from the north."
The winter air, fresh and frosty, filled her lungs and made her cough. Looking around, she saw black flecks moving across the horizon on their way to a town, village, or hamlet, wherever was next on their mission of destruction. Andokai closed her eyes and focused her mind. Almost immediately, she sensed the weak force field running through the earth beneath her, its energy harnessed by Nodon for his black art.
"We're in what's left of Terguria," she said slowly. "The enchanted realm was rich in magic energy, but there's almost nothing left."
All the same, she took the opportunity to replenish her powers, her face contorting with pain as she siphoned the magic from the land. A helmet popped out of the hole in the snow, followed by a pair of keen brown eyes that flicked to and fro.
"The sooner we get out of here, the better,"
Boindil said surlily. He emerged into the open while the others hurried up the last few steps.
"Now I know why I've been feeling so peculiar. It's this magical malarkey. It never did anyone any good."
He gave himself a shake and pushed the boulder back over the hole, thereby concealing the entrance to the underground network.
"Let's go."
"Wait!"
Tungdil had followed Andokai's gaze. He shivered. His breath left plump white clouds in the air, and his beard was already frozen solid.
"You're right, Mega. The orcs must have crossed over from the perished land. The hordes from Taboribor could never have got here this quickly."
"That makes it worse,"
commented Goimgar in his customary whine.
"If you don't shut up, I'll make you,"
Boindil threatened.
"Can't you see we're trying to think?"
"You're trying to think? You're not even capable of..."
Ironheart whirled around and threw himself on the artisan with a wild shriek. Goimgar ducked behind his shield and cried for help.
"Stop that, Boindil!"
The warrior paid no attention.
"He'll tear him limb from limb."
Tungdil launched himself on Boindil, and Bavrigor followed suit. The three dwarves disappeared in a cloud of snow from which loud curses, the sound of punches, and a great deal of coughing could be heard. With Jeroen's help, they succeeded in pulling Boindil away. By some miracle, he had refrained from using his axes, thus sparing the others more serious injuries. Their bloodied noses and bruised faces were proof enough of his formidable strength.
"I'm sorry," panted Boindil. "It's my fiery spirit."
He scrabbled in the snow for his helmet and tried to come up with an appropriate excuse.
"He provoked me, and then I..."
"Let's forget about it."
The right half of Tungdil's face was throbbing painfully, and he wasn't in the mood for delivering a lecture.
"You're welcome to slaughter the next lot of orcs by yourself."
Belindis took care of their wounds by clumping snow together and pressing it against their bruised and battered limbs. They set off in silence on a northeasterly bearing. Andokai drew alongside Tungdil.
"There's no smoke ahead," she said. "Nodon must have ordered the orcs to quell any resistance in Terguria and the other enchanted realms before taking on the human kingdoms."
She pointed to the east.
"There's a fortified city in Tabain, just across the border from here. I vote we find ourselves a room. We're not dressed for sleeping in the open, especially not when it's freezing outside. Besides, the citizens will be glad of a few extra swords."
Tungdil nodded his agreement. It was nighttime when the company reached the gates of a city marked on the map as Rudacre. Beroene's folk, Secondling Kingdom, Girdlegard, winter, 6,234th solar cycle. No sooner were the wagons rolling along the rail than Belendalin and Xamtis encountered the next setback. Nodon's troops had already started to occupy the tunnels and barricade the tracks. They managed to speed past the first band of waiting orcs, but a little farther along the tunnel, they were pelted with stones by ogres and trolls, while the second band of orcs charged onto the rail. The ambush cost them four wagons, But the remaining carriages turned off at a junction. Only now they were heading north and not west. Before they reached the next corner, Zamtis signalled for them to halt. She made her way to the king's wagon to confer with Belendilin.
"They've blocked the rail to my kingdom,"
she said, clenching her jaw in frustration.
"It's too dangerous for us to use the tunnels. For all we know, the orcs have sabotaged the tracks and will plunge straight into a chasm."
"Bislipur must have told them about the tunnels some time ago," said Belendilin.
His attendants saw their chance and redressed his wound.
"It doesn't bear thinking about. The dwarves built these tunnels for the protection of Gerdlegard, and now Teon's creatures are using them to conquer our kingdoms."
"We can't go overland, Belendilin."
Zamtis inspected his wound and shook her head.
"It's winter, and we won't find anything to eat on the way. None of us are equipped to trudge through snow and ice. We'd be lucky if half of us survived without freezing or starving."
She took off her helmet, and two plaits unfurled, draping themselves over her shoulders.
"We'll have to come up with another idea. The Red Range..."
"No, Zamtis."
He stopped short, gasping with pain. His strong hand gripped the side of the wagon while the dressing was removed.
"The Red Range is out of the question."
He pulled out a map and placed his finger over a dot at the heart of Gerdlegard.
"This is where we'll go. It's a somber place, I know, and a curse hangs over its history, but it's our only safe bet."
She ran a hand over her face as if to wipe away the dark thoughts and tiredness.
"What makes you so sure?"
"It's not connected to the tunnels, and there's no other way in. We'll have to cover a few miles overland, but once we're there, the women and children will be out of danger. The surrounding area is flat and easy to survey. We'll be safe until Tungdil or Gandagar finds us."
He cursed Bislipur silently. He could barely move because of the wound in his chest, and he felt dangerously weak.
"Gerdlegard is a big place. We can't count on sending messengers."
Zamtis studied the section of map beneath Belendilin's hovering finger.
"I've never heard of the place."
"We won't need messengers, provided we make sure everyone knows where we're going. Our two friends will find us in the normal course of events. They're bound to realize that the orcs have seized the tunnels, and they'll start making inquiries."
"Hmm."
The queen didn't seem entirely convinced.
"But then the beasts will be able to find us too. Is that what we want?"
"Absolutely."
He nodded vigorously, his brown eyes gazing earnestly.
"That's exactly my intention. I want Nadon to lead his army to us."
Zamtis looked at him as if he were out of his mind.
"He'll never show up in person, and if he does, we'll be dead. If you want a swift end, Belendilin, you should have stayed in the Blue Range. We needn't have bothered to escape."
"No, Nadon must come to us. He's been scouring Gerdlegard for the books and relics. If he thinks we've got them, he'll gather his hordes and attack us in person."
"But why would we want him to attack us?"
She leaned over the side of the wagon and looked at him imploringly.
"Belendilin, I need to know why I should lead my warriors to certain death."
He met her worried gaze.
"We need to draw Nadon close to us so Gandagar and Tungdil can find him. Otherwise he'll barricade himself somewhere in the depths of Gerdlegard, and we won't get a chance to use Keenfire against him."
At last, the queen saw the logic of the plan.
"So we'll act as bait. Of course, the only drawback is that no one knows when Gandagar or Tungdil will arrive."
"Or if they'll make it at all,"
he admitted frankly, closing his eyes. The loss of blood was sapping his strength, making him dizzy.
"But it's our only hope."
"Very well."
Zamtis let go of the wagon.
"But I must warn my subjects first."
"It's too late for that. The orcs know all about the tunnels. They'll be there already. It's the obvious thing to do."
He gripped her hand.
"Your Majesty, we must resign ourselves to being the last dwarven army in these lands. The task of destroying Nadon falls to us alone."
She took a deep breath and stared at his chapped hand.
"To think that they're butchering my folk, and I can't even stop them."
A tear trickled down her soft cheek.
"We must avenge ourselves 1,000 times over, Belendilin. The fields of Gerdlegard will be awash with orcish blood, and I shall pursue our enemies tirelessly, stopping only when my royal mace shatters on an ogre's skull."
Belendilin could see from a glance that her weapon would never break.
Suddenly, Zamtis looked concerned. "But what if Nadon defeats us before either expedition returns?"
He smiled at her, trying to look more confident than he felt.
"We won't let him," he said firmly.
Xamptis held her head high, her brown eyes scanning the rows of anxious, determined faces in the wagons. Some of the children were crying, their wails rising above the clunking armor and weaponry as the other passengers fidgeted in their seats. The air smelled stuffy and old.
"As you wish, Belendilin. I will follow your lead."
She shook his hand and returned to her wagon. The news of their destination spread like wildfire through the carriages. The secondlings had left their kingdom with misgivings, but on hearing where Belendilin was taking them, they reacted with disbelief, horror, and in a few cases, unmitigated fear. Rudaker, Kingdom of Tabayin, Girdlegard, Winter, 6234th Solar Cycle. Once again the company passed the sentry's muster without anyone remarking on Jeroen's great size. Rudaker was a vast place. The population was listed as 70,000 in one of Lotionen's books, but the study had been written some time ago, and the city was still expanding.
"I don't blame the orcs for not touching it," commented Boindil. "I'll wager that Rudaker could rally 30,000 trained defenders, not to mention the rest."
"It won't take long for the orcs to gather an army to rival them," said Andokai. "Either that, or the Alfar will capture the city by stealth."
Mifodania had taught them that nowhere was safe from Teon's hordes. If all else fails, Nodon will send one of his Famuli to tear down the walls and let the orcs in. Once they're inside the settlement, Rudaker will be lost. Humans are no match for orcs. She pointed to a tavern where a light was still burning in the bar. "Shall we go in?"
"I wouldn't want to live in a place as flat as this," Bavrigor said to Belindis. "How are you supposed to hide from the sun when there isn't any shade? It must be baking in the summer."
"I've nothing against warmth, provided it comes from my forge," said the smith, ushering him in front of her.
"Yes, there's nothing better than smiting red-hot iron on the anvil and letting the hammer sing." Tungdil sighed.
"Ah, I miss my smithy."
"Your smithy?" echoed Belindis, surprised. "I thought you were a fourthling. Aren't Gwimdil's dwarves supposed to be gem-cutters?"
"Exactly," said Gwimgar, in an I-told-you-so tone of voice. "Gem-cutters and diamond polishers, but he's not one of the..."
"I'm a fourthling, all right, but I've always felt more of an affinity for a craft beloved of all our folks,"
Tungdil cut in.
"He's not one of us," Gwimgar continued dismissively. "He's just a foundling. He lived with the Longans until someone talked him into thinking he was a fourthling, and then he took it upon himself to steal the crown."
"Oh," she said in confusion. "But if you were raised by men, who taught you to love the smithy?"
"I've always loved metalwork," he confided. "Even with sweat pouring into my eyes, arms as heavy as lead, and sparks singeing my beard, there's nowhere I'd rather be than at the anvil."
Her eyes lit up as she laughed.
"I know what you mean."
She rolled up her mail shirt to show him the scar on her right arm.
"Look, that's what Vrakas did to me when I tried to forge a sword. He doesn't approve of dwarves fashioning anything but axes and maces. He sent a message through the anvil, and I've never been tempted to make another one since."
Tungdil pulled off his glove enthusiastically and held out his left palm, which was marked by a deep red scar.
"It was a horseshoe. I knocked it off the anvil and put my hand out to catch it before it landed in the dirt. It was my best ever horseshoe, and I wasn't about to see it ruined."
Belindis was swept away by Tungdil's hitherto unsuspected passion for the forge. Soon they were deep in conversation about the particulars of metalwork and had quite forgotten their companions. Andokai called them to order by clearing her throat.
"There'll be plenty of time for talking later. First we need to find somewhere to stay."
Tungdil glanced around for the first time and saw that they were in a large room of staring humans. Jeroen towered above them like a statue. The enormous warrior would have looked more at home on a plinth outside the town hall than in the front room of a tavern. The innkeeper lodged them in a dormitory, usually used by travelling merchants. Because of the threat facing Girdlegard, trade between towns had practically ceased, and so Tungdil and his friends had the place to themselves at no extra cost. None of them felt like talking to the locals, so they ordered their meal to be brought to their room.
Feeling sidelined by Belindis's and Tungdil's enthusiasm for the smithy, Bavrigor tried to interest Belindis in the art of masonry, with only moderate success. He was a few notes into a traditional song of the Hammerfists when Tungdil delved into his knapsack and brought out the Sigurdaisy wood. Belindis saw him inspecting it and leaned over to get a closer look. The melody stopped abruptly, ending in an unintelligible grunt.
"Is it metal?"
The firstling frowned as she stared in fascination at the surface.
"I've never seen anything like it. We don't have it in our kingdom."
Tungdil gave her a brief account of the wood and its purpose and handed her the relic.
"The trees were all chopped down, so this is the last piece in Girdlegard. Except Gandagar's, of course. Without it, we'd never be able to make Keenfire."
She ran her hands over it reverently, trying to feel the details with her fingers. Bavrigor looked on jealously.
"Ha! Look at him stare!"
cackled Goimgar, hiccuping with glee.
"His one eye is falling out of its socket. Don't you get it?"
he jeered.
"She's not interested in you any more. You're a stone splitter, not a fancy smith. It's too bad you got the wrong gift."
He stopped to fill his pipe, then jabbed the stem toward Tungdil.
"Charlatans are in the habit of taking what doesn't belong to them."
Tungdil's cheeks reddened with anger and shame.
"That's enough from you, Goimgar," he said harshly. "Don't you see that spitefulness doesn't do you any favours?"
"Oh, I'm fine, thanks for asking,"
he hissed back.
"How would you feel with everyone picking on you all the time?"
"Why can't you see that this isn't about Gandagar or the succession? We're here to stop Nodon, because..."
Tungdil was about to launch into yet another explanation, but opted instead for the truth.
"But you know that, don't you? You don't want to understand. You like being the one with a grievance."
"What I think is my business, not yours. Anyhow, I was forced to join this expedition against my will, and I don't see why I should suffer in silence. It wasn't my idea to come on this mission, and I'm going to keep reminding you of that."
"Actually, Goimgar, you're not. No more insults, no more snide comments, no more cussed remarks, or I'll solder your lips together with red-hot metal. Do you understand? We need your hands and your craftsmanship, not your poisonous tongue."
Eyes flashing, he turned to Bavrigor and Boindil.
"As for you two, you're to leave him in peace. The teasing stops now."
Goimgar puffed furiously on his pipe, sending clouds of blue smoke shooting toward the ceiling. He got up and walked to the door.
"Don't worry, I'm not running away,"
he said scornfully when he saw the alarmed expression on Tungdil's face.
"I'm going outside, so I can walk up and down and be as insulting, snide and cussed as I like. And you'd better not get in my way."
He marched out, letting the door slam behind him. Rodario was the first to break the silence.
"Would anyone like the last of this delectable sausage?" he inquired. "I'm still a little hungry, but good manners dictate that..."
He broke off when no one showed any sign of responding, and decided that the lack of interest entitled him to help himself. Having finished the sausage with gusto, he dipped his hands in the tub of warm water provided by the publican and lathered the soap in preparation for a wash. He was watched by Boindil, who sighed incredulously to communicate his opinion of washing and water in general. The secondling stared up at Jeroen, who had taken his place on the floor while Andukai stood at the window and drew the rudimentary curtains. She had taken off her cloak.
"Well, Longan," he said to the giant, "you and I are both dying to slay a dozen runts, but don't forget, if we come across a pack of them, the first 10 belong to me."
Jeroen maintained his customary silence. Boindil shrugged, went to the window, and climbed out onto the roof. He soon spotted Goimgar.
"You should see this," he called out to the others. "The artisan is marching up and down the street."
"Tell him to come back in,"
said Tungdil, who was poring over the map. The city walls did nothing to assure him of their safety.
"We've had proof enough that the Alfar can slip past sentries with ease."
If their enemies had spies anywhere near the city, they would know by now that the odd-looking group had found its way to Rudacre.
"They'll come for us, and they won't give in until they've seen their mission through."
"He says he won't,"
Boindil bellowed through the window.
"Pretend you've seen an elf,"
suggested Bavrigor, offering a morsel of genuine dwarven cheese to Belindis.
"That should do the trick.
Andakai wrinkled her nose in disgust at the smell, but said nothing. Sure enough, a few moments later they heard the rush of footsteps on the stairs. Then the artisan burst into the dormitory, banging the door behind him and dropping the heavy oak panel into the latch. Boindil abandoned his post and climbed back inside, his chainmail clinking softly.
"You were lucky," he said gravely.
He curled his long plait into a pillow and lay down.
"The Alf was right behind you."
Goimgar turned a deathly shade of pale. Chapter 6. Rudaker, Kingdom of Tabayin, Girdlegard, Winter, 6234th Solar Cycle. Tungdil was woken by the sound of scraping metal. He opened his eyes. Jerun had got to his feet and drawn his mighty sword. He was holding the weapon outstretched in his right hand, blade angled toward the door. Andokai, still in bed, was wide awake too. She signaled to Tungdil, instructing him to keep quiet and lie still. They watched as a thin strip of wood slipped through the doorframe and rose toward the latch, pushing the oak beam noiselessly out of the catch. Little by little, the door came open. Faint light sloped into the dormitory from the corridor, illuminating the outline of a stocky figure. The intruder was roughly the size of a dwarf. He was wearing a helmet, and judging from his silhouette, was blessed with an exceptionally bushy beard. In his left hand, he was clutching a sack. The sight of Jerun stopped him in his tracks. Andokai gave the command. The giant shot forward to seize the intruder, but his phenomenal speed was not enough. Ducking away, the little fellow surprised them all by darting in instead of out.
"Stop right there!"
Tungdil sprang out of bed and barred his path. He made to grab him, but the dwarf proved astonishingly agile, leaving the startled Tungdil with a clump of whiskers in his hand. The intruder leapt nimbly onto the windowsill, hurled his sack at his pursuers, and fled across the roof. The bag smacked Tungdil in the chest, spilling its contents across the roughly hewn tiles. The clattering and jangling woke the others. Bowindel was up like a shot, running around the room, brandishing his axes and bellowing for the orcs to fight him if they dared. The rest of the company reached for their weapons. Belindis, dressed only in her undergarments, had taken up position on her bed and was gripping her axe with both hands. A shaft of moonlight slanted through the curtains, exposing her curves. It occurred to Tungdil that she probably didn't realize how much she was revealing, but he couldn't bring himself to look away.
"Where did they go?"
demanded Boindil, spoiling for a fight.
"We had an uninvited guest," said Andokai, leaning out of the window to see where the fellow had got to. "A dwarf. There must have been something funny about him because he didn't respond to my spell, and now he's gone."
"Gold!" exclaimed Tungdil in surprise, finally noticing the shiny coins on the floor. He bent down and scooped them up. Some of them were stuck together and left damp traces on his hands.
"And a dagger,"
observed Goimgar, who was cowering in a corner. Boindil picked it up and eyed it carefully.
"Forged on a dwarven anvil,"
he said slowly, handing it to Belindis.
"You're the expert. What do you reckon?"
Booted feet thundered up the stairs and across the landing to their room. The next moment, armored guards burst inside, halberds pointing menacingly toward them.
"Light! I need more light!"
shouted someone, and in an instant lamps were passed forward and more guards thronged inside.
"The coins and the knife!"
Tungdil was about to throw the gold out of the window and tell Boindil to put away the dagger, but already the room was bathed in light, revealing telltale red smudges on his fingers. The coins and the dagger were covered in blood.
"By Palandiel!"
exclaimed the captain of the guards, a strong man of some 40 cycles, with a small scar on the left side of his face.
"I've never seen such brazen criminals. Just look at the ruffians, sitting here calmly, dividing their loot."
His eyes shifted to the dagger in Boindil's hand.
"He's even holding the murder weapon!"
He waved his men forward.
"Arrest a lot of them! The men as well as the little fellows. We'll soon find out which of them were embroiled in this dastardly business."
"What business would that be, O worthy guardian of our municipal safety?"
inquired Rodario in his most amiable and gracious tone. He could easily have been inquiring about the weather. He adjusted his undergarments with aristocratic elegance,
Perhaps you would care to enlighten us.
Sir Darolam was murdered at knife point, not 3 streets from here.
He glared at Boindil.
The game's up. You were seen and followed.
He turned to one of his men.
There's a whole band of them. Professionals, I'll warrant.
I'm afraid there's been a terrible misunderstanding, chimed in Tungdil. He outlined what had happened before the arrival of the guards, holding up the lock of beard as evidence. On closer inspection, it turned out to be a snippet of fleece. The captain laughed in his face.
A likely story, groundling. I've never heard such nonsense.
I know it sounds strange, but...
Strange? It's preposterous. I'm arresting you and your accomplices in the name of King Nate. One of you will sign a confession soon enough. We've solved every murder in this city by putting the suspect on the rack.
As I was saying, Rodario resumed smoothly, the dwarves are nothing to do with us. He winked furtively at Tungdil. In fact, my companions and I were accompanying the lady when...
Save your stories for the interrogator,
the captain interrupted him harshly. Just then his dour face brightened, and he looked at them with sudden kindness.
Although, I must say, the evidence in your favour is quite compelling.
He took the strand of fake beard from Tungdil and gestured to the door.
We've been wasting our time, he told his guards. The real murderer led us here on false pretenses. We need to get after him before the trail goes cold.
But Captain, one of his subordinates protested vigorously,
we saw the dwarf run into the tavern. Get a move on,
the captain ordered.
Outside on the double. We'll never find him at this rate.
Realizing that he was not to be dissuaded, the baffled guardsman followed his instructions and exited the room. Soon afterward, their clunking armor could be heard through the open window.
That was close. Thank goodness he changed his mind.
Rodario breathed a sigh of relief.
Can we go to bed now?
Andakai was already packing her things. He'll come to his senses before too long. The sooner we leave, the better. The spell won't last forever.
What do you mean, come to his senses? He's always like that,
objected Boindil, scratching his beard in confusion.
She means the captain, not Rodario,
explained Tungdil with a grin. It dawned on him why no one had ever challenged Jeroen. The Maegar could obviously control people's thoughts.
She put a spell on him. Why else would he let us go?
He stared pensively at a tuft of fleece that had stuck to his fingers.
The whole thing was a setup, and it almost succeeded. Someone was trying to get us into trouble.
And it nearly worked. The villain disguised himself as a dwarf, said Bowen.